And when the computer came back online, they were ahead. There's something about this type of behavior that bothers a lot of people. Again, don't you think this is a small price to pay? You know, to make people feel like it's been a fair count?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McCauley, fortunately, our computer has never broken down on election night. Flat out, simple.
It's got behind, though. I know it has got behind. It's got six.
Mr. Chairman, at the rate the ballots come in, it is always behind. Now, what you're speaking of is we had some card readers that were disabled so that we were not reading as many cards per minute as we are normally capable of. I always just roar about computer breakdowns. I remember the first one. I remember it vividly. And I think it's a telling tale. It used to be that Don Sterling of the Oregon Journal got a bunch of newspaper deliverers, and our balcony was full of these people. And that's why we have the little blue elevator by my desk. The return sheets went up there to those kids. And there was a gentleman with the Associated Press by the name of Matt Kramer, who thence took over. They rewired our balcony. They put in key punch operators. They had a boy on a motorcycle, and it was one of the wettest nights I've ever seen. He wore a wetsuit, and they ran the punch cards that they generated down a wire outside the upstairs window. They had borrowed Oregon Auto's computer, and they had this all computerized. Now, this was the famous time when Alice Corbett, who was a state senator, came to our office at 1 minute to five and filed for county commission without withdrawing for the state senate. And in the aftermath of this, Alice Corbett was wiped from the ballot. So were several other folks who had subsequently filed for her senate seat, finding out that she was going to do this. One of those was Janet McLennan. Now, the first results that came out that night were that Janet McLennan had 418,000 votes for the city of Portland commissioner. And with that, they said Multnomah County's computer broke, and we didn't even have one yet. And I've just had it with stories of computers breaking. We have not had a computer failure, well, ever.
Someone, if I may, someone made a statement, and you may have not had a computer break. I think it's how the media possibly could interpret a, you know, if you're behind in the count or something, and then our folks out there saying, what's going on? We know it's fixed, you know, and then we try to explain to them, and it's not very easy to do.
Well, the system that Multnomah County has today, Mr. Chairman, feeds in continuously. The data vote system we had just prior, we had to send tapes, magnetic tapes, to data processing, which is a couple miles away. And this led to this perception because the results came in increments. All of a sudden things changed. And that did lead to that. But no, we have not had computer failure on election night ever.
Okay, now, I have no problem with it. I'm just saying that I know I've had people call me up and ask me some questions, and it was so certain a certain individual should win, and then, you know, if the feed wasn't right or there was an interruption in count or something, they get very suspicious, and then we have got to explain it. And we can't because we're not right there.
Mr. Chairman, another thing that goes on through this, and I've watched this through the years. Normally with large elections, we have, because we cannot handle everything in one location, we have reception centers around the county, normally about a dozen. And the results vary as they come in because one truck will come in from one locality. And all that is pouring in at once, so that you do have some changes. And just knowing the physical setup, you've got to expect them.
There's also claims on that system, too. Somebody takes them too long to get from one stop to the other. I mean, there's some suspicious folks out there, and some of them are candidates. Sorry. Further questions? Thank you very much, Alan. I would say to Mr. Phelps, I believe this is, we're talking about lawn signs in this bill. I really don't see a disclaimer or a date on a lawn sign as a, you know whose lawn sign it is. It's not like someone making mailing out for it. And I really did, you know, as one individual, I would like to see that changed. You constantly reuse the same lawn signs time after time. What you're doing is making a big mess out of it. I'm not in any section. I'm just going by subject matter, representative. I don't want them fooling with my lawn signs. Okay, that is all the testimony we have on 2212. We're going to close the hearing on 2212. And I'm going to take about 7 or 8 minutes in that recess to make sure everybody feels like going into 2152 because it's a little long bill. So we're going to recess till 25 after. We're going to. This is a hearing in possible session. Okay, we're going into hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2152. Gene Snyder.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the only thing we have received since our last meeting on this is a very short substitute amendment that maybe Mr. Snyder can briefly explain. And I will pass out a copy up to you.
Well, she's passing out the copy before you start in, Gene. I wanted to ask Representative Springer if he had some problems with the bill and he wanted to talk to SAFE and some folks. Would you, before Gene starts in, Dick, would you give the committee a rundown on your concerns, if you still have the same concerns?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I think there were 5 issues that I wanted to address in the amendments that I initially proposed and were hand-engrossed in a copy, I think, on January 31st. Mm-hmm. The first issue has to do with whether or not we need further amendment of the bill or our statute as it relates to the responsibility to pay the cost of attorney's fees incurred in the defense of an agency when that agency has been sued or an action is brought against that agency or department of the state. And traditionally, if the state accepts responsibility for that defense, then I guess it's assumed that the state GSA acting on behalf of the agency then also assumes responsibility for the legal costs. Now, a couple things that have suggested that the policy needs clarification so that agencies will know where they stand is the just concluded Penk case, where apparently there was an ad hoc decision that the state would accept defense. The claim, there were a couple different claims the state was going to accept responsibility for the defense. However, the legal fees were assessed directly against the agency that was the named defendant, the State Board of Higher Education. The cost of the legal defense were not assumed by GSA or by the pool or funds that exist normally to pay the cost of a claim or judgment or the cost of defense. Then we also received a letter from the Judicial Department, which raised a couple other particular cases in which there had been a question of interpretation as to who is going to be responsible for the legal fees, and apparently, again, because of a lack of clarity in existing policy, there was an ad hoc determination as to whether the agency, in that case the Judicial Department or GSA or the Attorney General's Office, how those costs were to be allocated. So the first amendment was to make it clear that when, in fact, the state has accepted the responsibility to defend an individual or an agency or the individual acting on behalf of the agency and within the color of law and his or her responsibilities, then quite clearly the legal cost will also be paid as part of that defense and will not be charged back to the agency. Now, it's my understanding that GSA has requested an attorney general's opinion on this. Mr. Nestle, who's here, has said that that's the case, I believe. It's my understanding that the attorney general's opinion or a draft of it is expected to be forthcoming perhaps as soon as this week. And Representative Bunn, I think, in response to this first set of questions, also suggested that, well, we probably need to look at the Tort Claim Act under ORS Chapter 30. And I think most parties will agree that it's, if we want to clarify and have a clear statement of public policy in this area, it's probably necessary to also address the Tort Claim Act. But that's the first issue I wanted to identify. The other four, just real briefly, were I wanted to hear SAFE, how they thought they could be affected by this, and Mr. Raitt, I believe, is here for that purpose. I also submitted an amendment to make it clear that the Professional Liability Fund is a mandatory insurance which is maintained by the state bar to protect the public against negligence that may be committed by an attorney in representation of those clients, that was not going to be affected by this because there's some degree of discussion over whether or not the state bar is a state agency or just what it is. The other two amendments relate to what I thought were maybe some policy issues in terms of General Services stating more clearly its responsibility to provide insurance, if you will, for agencies. I thought it was appropriate to look at whether or not General Services also was the agency that ought to be responsible for administration of other insurance-like or indemnification programs the state operates to protect the public. And those two are the Motor Vehicle Victim Accident Fund, which has been within the Department of Motor Vehicles for a few years. It reimburses individuals who have been injured on the highways, need medical care. Basically, it helps the health care providers pay those costs. It's like an insurance scheme. We all contribute to it. And the second is the Victims Fund, which is also like an insurance or like an indemnification program that's been run for a few years by the Department of Justice, where if a person's a victim of a crime, they can file a claim, and if they meet certain prerequisites, they can also receive reimbursement for some of their special costs or out-of-pocket losses as a result of being the victim of a crime. So those are basically the five policy issues raised in my amendments, and Mr. Snyder and I met last week to review briefly a better way of trying to accomplish the first issue, at least as far as the language I proposed on page one of the bill and section two of the bill. And he and I more or less agreed that the amended language would be fine. An issue I guess we still need to resolve before we get past that is what changes do we need to make in ORS Chapter 30? And I think some people are going to suggest we can do that in another bill. We don't need to address it here. I haven't yet reached that conclusion because I don't know what the other bill is yet. I think we're still waiting to hear what the Attorney General's opinion is going to be, and I think some folks are prepared to testify on that subject this morning.
Thank you.
I hope that's helpful in terms of background and why I brought these amendments.
Okay, then. Gene, do you want to begin, please?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'd like to address the first concern that Representative Springer mentioned. Under existing law, the liability fund is required to file and track directly with the wording in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. The problem under existing law is that the term tort is being continually expanded by the courts, and also it creates confusion in it doesn't permit us to identify up front to state agencies whether we will be responsible for certain types of actions that may or may not be torts. The bill, House Bill 2152, without amendments, would allow us to define coverage up front for coverages other in addition to those defined by the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and we feel that we would be able to, by administrative rule, tell state agencies we could cover other types of actions than those specifically defined in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So I think that we would be able to deal with the problems mentioned by Representative Springer without amendment to our bill. The wording that we had worked out with Representative Springer on the first page on line 13 specifically states that if we provide coverage in response to law, then we're obligated to also provide the related legal expenses that go with that coverage. The original amendment we were concerned about because it seemed to be much broader in the sense and not defined as precise as we would like to have seen it. The second amendment dealing with professional liability insurance fund, we have no problems with that amendment. We believe that is fine. The two issues two final issues that, well, let me go back and just speak briefly to the SAFE issue. And I don't think that I can answer for SAFE, certainly, but I can say that we would expect to work with SAFE like we would work with any insurance company in terms of coordinating service programs for state agencies and paying premiums, working out evaluation of reserves on particular cases, those kinds of things, as is done in the private sector. On the last two issues, on the issues of whether the Motor Vehicles Accident Fund and the Crime Victims Fund should be transferred to General Services, we have a concern about that for these reasons. We have been providing central services to state agencies, and we believe that these two funds are more allied with the general public. We would be changing our focus somewhat in starting to deal with the general public on these types of funds. In addition, we're going to be fully challenged staff-wise to implement the legislation in House Bill 2152, and those are the reasons that we're concerned about that those two issues.
Questions? Representative Springer.
Well, are we going to hear from Mr. Nestle or anyone else about this Attorney General's opinion and what that's going to do? Or might do? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, I might just briefly mention that the reason we mentioned the Oregon Tort Claims Act as a potential vehicle for amendment would be that then we would be required under that situation to provide that coverage if it was amended to include such things as Title VII. So that's the reason we proposed that direction.
Well, I guess just as a follow-up, I think I understand you to say that let's take the Penk case. If tomorrow somebody, say the faculty at the community colleges, decide they want to file a suit alleging basically the same problem, how do the community colleges know if this bill passes, whether or not they're covered, and who's going to pay the cost of legal defense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer.
If, assuming they're part of your fund, yes. And decide to opt in under that.
If House Bill 2152 were law and that situation happened, we would be able to provide coverage to the community colleges at their request, and we would define the coverage and charge a premium appropriate to that.
Okay, you would be able to at their request. Mm-hmm. Who advises the agency or the community college that they should have that kind of coverage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, we have a loss control staff that is working with state agencies right now identifying the risks that they're exposed to. Now that we have knowledge of the Pink case, we would it would be appropriate for us to call that to their attention, that that is an exposure and an issue that they should be concerned about.
If I may.
Yeah, continue, please.
Well, I guess, you know, the Penk case focused on one legal theory. The fertile minds of plaintiff's attorneys, I'm sure, are going to come up with all kinds of new theories that it's impossible, or new causes of action, potential liability, that it's impossible for anyone to anticipate. And I guess I'm kind of curious how, unless we state as a matter of public policy that this coverage is going to be, you know, exclusive, at least to the extent that we can foresee, and how are we going to assure a state agency that if there's some new cause of action that doesn't fall in apparently what you've defined by rule as ought to be the appropriate coverage of what they've requested upon your advice, they're hanging out in terms of exposure. That's, I guess, the situation I want to avoid in the future, and I think we need to state that pretty clearly as a matter of public policy in the statute. The rulemaking authority is fine, but there's some things where the public policy is so important that, you know, that's our job, notwithstanding the rulemaking authority that we may delegate. And I think that's kind of an issue we have to address here to make sure that those agencies just know where they stand, and so you folks know where you stand, too. That's more a statement than a question, I guess, but maybe someone can tell me what's coming down on this AG's opinion or how it's going to deal with this issue, and respectively, what our choices are.
Representative Jones.
Currently, When agencies provide their own insurance, not coming through General Services, they have coverage specified by the insurance company at whatever they have requested. Is that not true?
That's correct.
Okay. What is different between that agency having to pay the cost for coverage for things not covered today, different than when General Services is the broker for the insurance? What will be different?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, the Department of General Services, well, under existing law, agencies are required to come through us for the liability coverage. And we would have the flexibility of funding that through the liability or through the insurance fund as opposed to going and buying commercial insurance. Right now, we would have to buy commercial insurance for a Title VII kind of action. This bill will give us the flexibility to handle that through our funding mechanism. So that would be the difference. And we would be able to define a coverage just like could be done in an insurance policy.
Okay, if I may follow up. My thinking is the end result is the agency is going to pay for it in higher premiums if they have expanded coverage, or they're going to pay for it if they are not covered through another method. It's whether General Services pays for it or the agency pays for it that is in question. Is that... Mm-hmm. Okay, in the end, the public pays for it no matter what. The taxpayer is still paying the bill.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, under our bill, we would be able to, the agency then would have the choice if they wanted to absorb that risk by the agency or by insurance protection for that.
So they have options available to them, and then the advice they would receive regarding what coverage they had and what it actually is, what they're being protected against, would be specified very clearly from your people's expertise, and then they would, in writing, know what they're covered for, just as they would if they were providing commercial insurance today.
Exactly.
Further questions? Representative Springer.
Well, maybe just to highlight this, I know members got a copy of the letter that we received a couple weeks ago from the State Court Administrator, Mr. Linden, speaking on behalf of the Judicial Department, which is one of our three branches of government. And to the extent we haven't heard a response, I guess I would invite one. On page 2 of his letter, he, after citing a couple of examples where they weren't sure what their coverage was or what their liability was for legal costs, they state, the point I want to make by these examples is that the determination of whether or not a claim against a state agency or employee is covered by the state liability fund appears to be made somewhat on an ad hoc basis and without the benefit of any guidelines in the form of written rules or policies. This lack of certainty and predictability creates obvious problems for an agency or department attempting to assess its exposure to liability and to project its budget needs. So we're hearing from at least one agency or department of government it says what we've got now isn't sufficient for them to know where they stand. And I'm not sure that this bill, at this point, answers their question. And I guess to the extent we want to allow it to be done by rule, I feel a little uncomfortable with that, as opposed to us making the policy choice by statute. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Fine. Identify yourself, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Gary. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. If I can respond to Representative Springer's question and also his reference to Mr. Linden's letter. He is correct that this bill, House Bill 2152, does not respond to Mr. Linden's concern, nor do we believe it is the appropriate vehicle in which to do so. There are two issues that have to be maintained separately in your consideration. The first issue is what kind of insurance coverage do you want to authorize General Services to obtain on behalf of state agencies? That issue is addressed in House Bill 2152, and it would expand it. And Representative Jones is correct that by expanding it, you would make it possible for state agencies to go to General Services and know exactly what kind of protection they are buying when they purchase insurance coverage through General Services. The second issue, the issue that is addressed by Representative Springer's questions regarding legal fees and by Mr. Linden in his letter, has to do with what is a tort, what is the definition of a tort in ORS Chapter 30 that will trigger automatically the responsibility for general services to pick up the costs of defense. The Attorney General's office defends approximately 2,700 active cases in the state and federal appellate and trial courts right now. Of those, only a percentage of them are classified as torts for which general services picks up the cost. The rest of the costs are picked up by the agency that is being sued. And so the question, the policy question that will be presented to the legislature at some point in this session, probably this week, when the Attorney General's opinion is issued, is how broadly do you want to define the term tort, and how much do you want to concentrate responsibility for defending the state in indemnifying and paying the cost of defense in general services? That is a policy question. There are two different arguments that you can make about whether Title VII cases, for example, ought to be covered as a tort, or whether they should be picked up by individual agencies. Our point is that House Bill 2152 is not the vehicle in which to do that, because House Bill 2152 does not address the definition of tort in the Tort Claims Act. There are other bills that provide an appropriate vehicle that amend the Tort Claims Act. I believe they're pending in the House Judiciary Committee now. House Bill 2154, for example, which discusses the question in the Tort Claims Act of when a state employee would be covered and entitled to defense when he's sued for a tort. Just to give you a preview, as you requested, Representative Springer, of what our opinion will say with respect to what is a tort. I can't give you the bottom line, but I can tell you a little bit of the history. The Tort Claims Act was passed in 1969, and it defines tort as including a violation of 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, which is a civil rights claim brought generally in federal court, although they can be brought in state court. Other than that, the definition of tort is virtually non-existent, but the cases have defined tort to be any cause of action, including a cause of action based on statute, that does not sound in contract. And so the definition that the courts have adopted to define a tort for purposes of applying the statute of limitations and other things is very, very broad. The question regarding Title VII in the Pink case specifically is whether a violation of Title VII, which is not specifically mentioned in the Tort Claims Act, is intended to be covered as a tort, or whether it is the kind of action that agencies are responsible for covering the defense costs on individually. The reason that that issue has never been addressed is in the legislature is because the legislature acted in 1969 to define tort, and it wasn't until the mid-70s, 1972, that Title VII was made applicable to the state. And so this legislature never had an opportunity to address that policy question. You will have that opportunity in this session, because obviously the confusion that has arisen and that it has caused concern on Representative Springer's part, as well as our client agencies and our part as well, in deciding where the responsibility for defense lies, is something that you have to address.
Let me ask, how much flexibility do agencies have in determining how much insurance they have and how much is demanded of them to, you know, how much coverage? Do they have any flexibility in determining just how much they need? Because you said they had to make application with General Services.
Mr. Chairman, they're required to insure their property with us. We've left that part of the statute in Chapter 278 as is. There's been no change there. In regard to the liability, they're required, or we are required, to provide the coverage that is defined in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. And that would continue under this legislation.
What if they wanted to, what if they didn't want to insure with the General Services? Are they allowed to insure outside of the General Services?
Mr. Chairman, no.
They have to insure.
As long as the statute, the property is required, they have to cover that through the fund. And the liability has to be provided by the fund. The coverages that they need, other than those coverages, have to be purchased by commercial policies, and that's done through our department.
So you do the purchasing through commercial. Did you want to say something?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Nestle. I'm with the Attorney General's office and assigned to the Department of General Services. And I think part of the difficulty we have in this situation is there are two sources of coverage provided to each state agency. Number one, there is the liability fund itself, which acts as a self-insurance pool of money. That fund can only be expended to defend and pay the judgments or settlements in the cases that are referred to in the Tort Claims Act. And then the second area is the area wherein the state, rather than relying exclusively on that fund that the state holds and administers, goes out and buys a private insurance policy. And the Department of General Services has broader authority to purchase private insurance for various coverages than the coverage that is permitted under the Oregon Tort Claims Act to be provided out of the liability fund. So are there instances in which there is a potential for both overlaps and for gaps as to what is covered when you view both of the forms of coverage? I think that's where much of the difficulty is coming. From General Services at this point has authority to buy private insurance for a range of risks that are broader than those that it is required and limited to in coverage directly out of its liability fund.
Okay. How do you determine the, and I'm sure I've asked you this before, but I want a little fresher. Gene, how do you determine who's going to carry the coverage? Is there a bidding process, or do you